Pro-Russia forces in Donetsk say that heavy shelling by Ukrainian forces has caused multiple casualties. A UN refugee chief says that Britain's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda sets a catastrophic precedent. And Syria condemns Turkish plan to establish a safe zone in the northern part of the country, saying it will use all means to end the occupation. This is World News with me, your host, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Pro-Russia forces say that Ukrainian shelling in Donetsk has killed five people, including a child. According to local authorities and Russian media, Ukrainian strikes have targeted a market and a hospital. 22 people were also injured. Fierce fighting is raging in the eastern Donbas region. Ukrainian President Zelensky is making urgent calls for more weapons from the West to confront Russian forces. Is confident that his troops can reclaim the lost territory if the Western allies speed up their arms deliveries. Meantime, the Russian military says it's destroyed a large cache of American European weapons in Donetsk on Monday. For weeks, the warring sides have been locked in a battle for control over Severodonetsk. The capture of the city could pave the way for Moscow to fully conquer the mainly Russian-speaking Donbas region. The UN refugee chief has denounced the UK government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda just the day before the first plane was due to depart. Filippo Grandi described London's plan as all wrong. The UN agency has expressed concerns about a lack of legal redress in Rwanda and potential discrimination against asylum seekers. The UN refugee chief warned the plan sets a precedent that's catastrophic. On Monday, UK Court of Appeal upheld the decision to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. And that was after a high court refused to grant a temporary injunction suspending the first flight. The British government has shrugged off criticism of the plan. It says that one-way flights to Rwanda are aimed at deterring others from entering Britain through the English Channel by illegal routes. Some 10,000 people have crossed the channel in small boats so far this year. Staying with the UK, the Northern Ireland Protocol stipulated in the Brexit deal still remains a sticking point between the UK and the EU. Now the British Foreign Secretary claims that London's plan to overwrite some post-Brexit trade rules does not break international law.
We are changing the protocol. We're not getting rid of the protocol. I think that's important to acknowledge. We want to protect North-South trade. I can give the manufacturers that reassurance. But what we need to see is East-West trade working properly, removing a lot of the customs bureaucracy that's been stopping trade taking place and adding costs for consumers, but also re-establishing those tax policies applying to Northern Ireland as well as to Great Britain. And I have more.
The Trust added that there is no reason for the EU to take legal action over the UK's plans to change parts of the agreement, and that after the bloc threatened against London's unilateral revision of Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade arrangements. On Monday, Britain introduced legislation which would remove customs checks and some goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. London says the changes are necessary to improve trade and reduce bureaucratic red tape, but a 27-member EU calling it a violation of the deal. The EU Commission has said it is considering reopening a suspended infringement procedure against Britain, adding that it will not renegotiate the deal. Okay, to get a clear picture and some more explanation on that, I'm joined by Said Puraza in our London bureau. Said, good to have you with us. So can we call this latest development and look at it as a kind of prelude to a trade war between the EU and the UK?
Quickly, Behruz, given what is at stake here, the UK government potentially rolling back on parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol signed between the United Kingdom and the EU not too long ago. Basically, what this new legislation endorsed by the Foreign Office, the trust that you played a soundbite of earlier, of what it does is it rips up parts of the protocol and changes it in four key ways, but I'm going to mention two for the purpose of brevity. One thing it does is that it creates that check-free green lane that you mentioned earlier for goods moving from the UK into Northern Ireland goods that will not move on to the Republic of Ireland. And another thing, another way that we will change the protocol is that it wants to, for the European Court of Justice to have no final say on disputes. And that is particularly troublesome from the standpoint of the European Union. The UK claims it is doing it all within the law, that they are blaming the European Union for not changing the protocol, basically blaming the European Union for this stalemate that they are in now. That has had angry reactions and opposition from the European capitals. As a matter of fact, the European Commission Vice President Maris Sefcovic said that the EU will not renegotiate the protocol. And as you said earlier, they're going to restart the infringement procedure. It doesn't stop there. The Republic of Ireland, a key nation in all this, also reacting to it angrily, saying, look, this is a breach of an international treaty, which is international law, and there's only one way to call it that. Across the border in the north, in Northern Ireland as well, reaction from Sinn Féin, the nationalist party that won in the recent elections in Northern Ireland, calling it disgraceful. And also, the only support, let's say, that it has received has been from the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, who won't enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin, the nationalists, over the Northern Ireland protocol. They want it either scrapped or significantly changed. So what you're looking at is a row that's been going on for 2 years between the two sides now. On the one hand, Boris Johnson trying to appeal and please the Brexiteers in the DUP in Northern Ireland, but on the other, angering members of his own political party, Brussels, as well as, let's not forget the words of the American president and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi over the consequences of a breach of the protocol and endangering potentially the Good Friday Agreement. So we are, yes, looking at a potential trade war, but it also means on a final note is that Brexit is not quite done yet.
Okay, thanks for the thorough explanation. Saeed Puruza in our London Bureau. Now, moving on, Syria has condemned Turkey's plan to establish a so-called safe zone in the Aqaba northern part of the country as, quote, brutal aggression. The Syrian People's Assembly made the comment in a statement saying that Turkey's plan is aimed at causing demographic changes in the area. Damascus says that Ankara's efforts to occupy more Syrian territory threaten regional and international peace and security. It emphasized that it has the right to use all means to counter the illegitimate presence of Turkish troops along with affiliated terrorist groups. Last month, the Turkish president said that Ankara was planning to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria, a move that Damascus denounced as a shameful act. Iran has published a written response it presented to the International Atomic Energy Agency last month in response to allegations of three undeclared nuclear sites. In the newly released document, Iran clarifies that the IAEA's allegations are based on fabrications provided by Israel as a non-member and therefore lack legal credibility. The document has presented comprehensive technical details on the alleged sites. It also criticized the agency for ignoring Iran's clarifications. Tehran had sent its document prior to the last Wednesday meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors. In that meeting, the Board of Governors approved a resolution accusing Iran of failing to adequately cooperate with the agency. Tehran called the resolution politicized. Meantime, the Iranian foreign minister said that the U.S. Pushed for the anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA despite progress and indirect talks between the two sides over the 2015 deal. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Washington's move was aimed at putting political pressure on Tehran and gaining more concessions in the negotiations.
Despite continued indirect messages between Tehran and Washington, as well as progress made in the talks, the U.S. unexpectedly submitted a resolution at the IAEA to put political pressure on the Islamic Republic and to gain more concessions in the indirect negotiations. Although the U.S. had informed Iran that the resolution was empty of content, the U.S. itself prompted Tehran to issue a stern warning to Washington over such measure. Iran put forward a new political package, a new initiative to the negotiating table. the U.S. had welcomed the initiative, but at the same time pushed for the resolution.
The foreign minister said that Iran, in reaction to the U.S. move, increased its nuclear activities at some of the sites. He added that a U.N. nuclear watchdog has been informed about those activities. The top diplomat underlined, however, that Tehran will not leave the negotiating table and will continue the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. The IAEA resolution accuses Iran of failing to explain uranium traces found at three of its undeclared sites. Amin Abdullahian was speaking during a joint presser with his visiting Pakistani counterpart, Bilawal Bhutta Zardari. The two diplomats also discuss other regional issues, including Yemen, Palestine, and Afghanistan. In other news, China has lashed out in the United States after Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin accused Beijing of adopting a more coercive and aggressive approach in the region, including near Taiwan.
I would like to stress that by repeatedly spreading disinformation and painting an ugly picture of China, the U.S. could only further expose its ill intention to sow discord and the true nature of its hegemonic practices, an exercise of power politics.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman blamed the United States for fueling tensions by militarizing the Asia-Pacific region. He cited America's increasing deployment of military jets and warships in the South China Sea. He also accused Washington of supporting those who are seeking the independence of Taiwan and said that such measures are the biggest threat to the peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taiwan, a self-ruled island that China considers as part of its territory. Recently, President Biden also angered China after her vow to defend Taiwan militarily if attacked.
China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese Defense Minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp. In terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both of these people laid out their positions on this, but the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war.
The latest round of altercation between the two countries comes as they held their first face-to-face talks on the sidelines of a summit in Singapore on Friday. Now, during the event, China also stated that besides military provocations, Washington is trying to, quote, hijack countries in the Indo-Pacific region. And that in reference to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which the U.S. announced in May and involves 13 countries, excluding China.
The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade, but they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China. But the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure, both militarily and economically.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, a well-known Conservative donor has said he cannot support Prime Minister Boris Johnson after accusing him of overseeing an unconservative government, delivering a pathetic tax-cutting pledge and refusing to heed calls to change the course of his premiership. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer's policy editor Michael Savage. The piece is titled, Tory donors and polarised party losing faith in Johnson cult. Britain, a well-known Conservative donor has said he cannot support Prime Minister Boris Johnson after accusing him of overseeing an unconservative government, delivering a pathetic tax-cutting pledge and refusing to heed calls to change the course of his premiership. With the Prime Minister facing a split over Brexit within days and a mounting revolt among party backers after last week's humiliating confidence vote, the hotelier Sir Rocco Forte said he will not put up with the direction that Boris Johnson is taking the Conservative Party. He told The Observer that Johnson has mishandled the Partygate scandal and been badly damaged by last Monday's confidence vote, in which 148 MPs opposed the Prime Minister. However, in a sign of wider despair over the performance of Johnson's administration, Sir Rocco Forte said that it was simply not a Conservative government. He was elected to deliver Brexit and win an election, which he did. And he's probably the only person who could have done it in the way it was done, he said. But those of us who supported him expected him to build a competent team around him, as he did when he was Mayor of London, and govern effectively. That just hasn't happened. And the reality of this government is that it's not a Conservative government. If you're running a business, you don't feel this government is behind you in any way. That's what a Conservative government is supposed to be about. Unless he changes tack and does something about that, which doesn't look likely because he suggested he's doing all the things that need to be done already, I don't think people on the right of the Conservative Party, like me, will put up with this. Unless I see a change, I don't feel I can support him into the future. I supported a Conservative government. Unless I see a Conservative government, what's the point of supporting it? Sir Rocco Forte handed Boris Johnson £100,000 for the last election campaign. Worryingly for Johnson, other donors are also losing faith. But there are competing views on how the Prime Minister should fix things. John Caldwell, the billionaire founder of Phones for You, who gave the Tories £500,000 before the last election, would not state if Johnson should go, but called for more investment. John Caldwell said, "Rather than prudence, we need to borrow on an unprecedented scale and invest wisely, productively and profitably," he said, pointing to renewable energy, infrastructure, subsidies for industry and apprenticeships. It comes as a former Conservative Party chairman, Chris Patten, said the party was in the grip of the Johnson cult, with cabinet ministers unwilling to turn on him. The party was in the midst of a very long nervous breakdown. Lord Patten added, "We don't have a Conservative government at all, but an English nationalist party which is populist, but fatally without being popular." Unease among donors and grandees is another sign that, despite relative calm among MPs since last Monday's vote, Boris Johnson remains on unstable ground. A confrontation is already building over Brexit. On Monday, the government published its plans to effectively override the Northern Ireland Protocol, the section of the Brexit deal with the European Union governing the region. While the government has been trying to reassure MPs that the proposals will not reignite Brexit tensions, The Observer has been told by multiple sources that the government's bill still includes sections that override the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed with the European Union, a move that critics say is illegal and will spark a rebellion. One Conservative source said, The government is lying to its own MPs and the media about the illegal focus of this bill. The Tory party is sleepwalking into a repeat of the Owen Paterson vote and Partygate, yet again positioning the party full square in support of lawbreaking over the rule of law. It is understood that the key legal advice was not presented to the cabinet committee overseeing the plans. The Observer has established that Thomas D. Grant, an academic lawyer who worked in the U.S. State Department during the Donald Trump administration and has written legal articles supporting a hard Brexit, has been advising on the bill. White House sources, however, said he offered advice and was not a central part of the legal team. There have been frantic legal and political negotiations taking place between Boris Johnson, his cabinet, and MPs in the past week. Boris Johnson had been pressed to take a hard line and effectively override the Northern Ireland Protocol. It creates a major flashpoint for Johnson. Some pro-Brexit MPs, including some in the European Research Group, ERG, that caused persistent problems for Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, could withdraw their support for him if the plans are seen as too weak. However, moderate Conservatives are also threatening to rebel if they deem that the legislation breaks international law. A European Research Group source laughed off the idea that they had a Machiavellian plot to take control of the Conservative Party by holding Johnson to ransom. They said that it was most important to ensure the European Court of Justice did not oversee Britain's laws. There have already been signs that as the immediate impact of the COVID pandemic recedes, clashes over Brexit are reopening. Mark Jenkinson, the Conservative MP for Workington, told the Daily Mail that lefties, lords and loveys were showing they still did not accept the referendum result. The Daily Mail also claimed in an essay that a remainder counter-revolution has begun, and replacing Boris Johnson could lead to the reversal of Brexit.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently taking inspiration from the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam gives his governance program. And we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about piety, and he says that those communities that have learnt the lessons from the past and are able to reflect those lessons in their present day life, they will be such that they will have piety in them, and that piety will stop them from entering into doubtful areas and confusing areas, and they will rather always be stuck to the right direction and the right path. So we're talking about piety, and we say that piety is not just sitting with a rosary and remembering God in the apparent sense and just praying or fasting and things like that, which are very important in their own sense, in their own right, but they have to be accompanied with the actual piety. And that actual piety, as we said in the previous session, is to be careful, to be sensitive, to be accurate, to have that kind of seriousness. And that is actually one dimension of piety.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We were talking about one dimension of piety, of the right form of piety, and that is that attention, that seriousness, that accuracy, that sensitivity and care that a person has to have. There is a narration from Imam alayhi salam, from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, where they were asked, what is taqwa? And he says that, أَنْ لَا يَفْقِدَكَ اللَّهُ حَيْثُ أَمَرَكَ وَلَا يَجِدَكَ حَيْثُ نَهَاكَ, means that piety is that Allah should not see you absent, should not find you absent in a place where He has commanded you to be, and He should not find you present in a place where He has avoided you to be there. In other words, this narration is telling you to be accurate, to be sensitive about the commandments of God, about where you are walking, about where you are traveling, about the direction you are taking in your life. Always to have that sensitivity, that care, that onlooking, to be always looking over yourself. And that is why we are always told to take muhasaba, to take account of your actions, to take account of your thoughts, to see where you are directing, where you are going, to reevaluate some of your actions and some of your thoughts and some of your activities. And if a person is always careful in this way, then he will not, fall asleep. Rather, he will not go into a state of oblivion. He will always have that state of wakefulness in the direction of the truth. This is what we call piety. If you get stuck somewhere where you know you're in the wrong direction, then ask for help so that you come out of that situation and be in the right state. Be sensitive, be careful. Look at where you're going, who you are working with, how you're working, what is your workplace, all of that, you need to be very, very careful about that. That is one dimension of piety that Imam Ali alayhi salam, also and other Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have talked about.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We were talking about what is piety, and we discussed one dimension, which is the sensitiveness and care, and that state of wakefulness and always having that state of carefulness when dealing with your situation in life and where you are and what you do. Another dimension, which is a very important dimension, which is also the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have talked to us about, is taqwa is to
to prepare a shield for yourself, to create a fence for yourself, such that other things, evil things, dark things, enemies who want to misguide you cannot penetrate through that fence. And this is the kind of that fence or that shield that if it comes, if it is there, if it is present, with regards to the normal illnesses and sicknesses that we have in our day-to-day life, we call that vaccination. You know, we say vaccine. A person who is vaccinated from a certain illness means he has a shield within his existence that stops the viruses and bacteria to enter. Although the bacteria can enter, but they get destroyed, and a person is protected from that sickness. Piety is like that. It's that is to vaccinate yourself so that evil cannot affect you. The dark forces cannot affect you. The evil intentions of others do not destroy you and do not take you away from the right path. This is called spiritual vaccination. So piety is actually the spiritual vaccination that you need to have. And how do you get vaccinated in reality? That's the first dimension that I spoke about. That care, that attention, sensitivity that you create within yourself with time is what will actually vaccinate you and the society from misguidance and from destruction and from entering the path of, you know, deviation and doubtfulness. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He always keeps us in the state of piety so that we can achieve the purpose of our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مرجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
According to tracking service FlightAware, over Memorial Day weekend, there were more than 2,800 cancellations and 20,644 delays among U.S. airlines. The experts see that as an early indicator of a turbulent summer travel season because of a pilot shortage, because of increased consumer demand and a recent rise in fuel prices, and disagreements over which COVID-19 restrictions should remain in place. We now present you an article written by Eric Berger. The piece is titled Pilot Shortages, Fuel Prices and COVID, US Braces for Travel Chaos. On Friday night, 10th of June, Laura Waring needed to fly from Newark, New Jersey to San Diego, California to help set up her healthcare information technology company's conference, which was scheduled to start in the coming days. But after her flight was repeatedly delayed and then cancelled, Laura Waring slept for about 45 minutes on a cot at Newark Airport before she woke up cold and uncertain how she would get to California. That was just the start of her troubles. And according to travel industry experts, Laura Waring's experience will likely not be unique among people flying in the coming months. According to tracking service FlightAware, over Memorial Day weekend, there were more than 2,800 cancellations and 20,644 delays among U.S. airlines. The experts see that as an early indicator of a turbulent summer travel season ahead because of a pilot shortage, because of increased consumer demand and a recent rise in fuel prices, and because of disagreements over which COVID-19 restrictions should remain in place. Matthew Howe, senior manager of travel intelligence at Morning Consult, a market research firm, said, "We're really seeing revenge travel. People having had 2 years of pent-up demand and wanting to go out and travel. On the flip side, I think we have seen that some airlines may be struggling to meet the demand." According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the number of airline pilots and engineers decreased from 84,520 in May of 2019 to 81,310 in May of 2021, an almost 4% decrease. And according to the Bureau, the country will need more than 14,000 new pilots each year for the next decade. The Regional Airline Association, a trade group, stated in its 2021 annual report, "Workforce shortages predating the pandemic have been accelerated, particularly for technicians and for pilots, who have long been entering the career in fewer numbers than those retiring." According to Michael Taylor, practice lead for travel intelligence at JD Power, a consumer research firm, the shortage means people seeking to travel this summer will likely face fewer options than before the pandemic. For example, before the pandemic, airlines may have had departures every hour for major hubs like Chicago and Atlanta, Georgia. He said now they will only happen every 90 minutes and the planes will be busier. Michael Taylor said the airlines are going to be redeploying a larger fleet with fewer city destinations in their flight system. Michael Taylor explained fewer flights and a shortage of staff translates into less slack in the system, whereas before the pandemic, an airline may have had crews at an airport on standby in case of an unexpected event. Airlines aren't doing that as much because they need those staff on flights. Then when a storm hits and delays a flight, there may not be substitutes for the scheduled crew members, who the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, only allows to fly a certain number of hours each day. Dennis Tadger, a spokesperson for Allied Pilots Association, the union for American airline pilots, said the airline is loading up pilots' schedules to the absolute maximum. Tadger said, "When you build a schedule with very little buffer because you have disproportionately assigned your pilots reserve duty, it's very expensive and it's very ineffective, and it ultimately leads to a less reliable operation." Airlines are adjusting to the new challenges. Delta Airlines announced on 26th of May that it would cancel 100 daily flights from 1st of July to 7th of August around the US and Latin America. Alison Orsband, Delta Airlines' Chief Customer Experience Officer, said in the announcement, "More than any time in our history, the various factors currently impacting our operation, weather and air traffic control, vendor staffing, increased COVID case rates contributing to higher than planned unscheduled absences in some work groups, are resulting in an operation that isn't consistently up to the standards that Delta Airlines has set for the industry in recent years." Alicia Johnson, a 28-year-old mental health therapist, was scheduled to fly back to Detroit, Michigan from Minneapolis, Minnesota when her cousin's Memorial Day weekend wedding, when she received a notification on Sunday morning, 12th of June, that her Monday morning flight had been cancelled. She was rebooked for 1 3 hours later. Alicia Johnson, who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, said, "It just added stress to us having to rearrange transportation, but also having backup plans on what would happen if that one also got cancelled or if they overbooked it." She and her fiancé decided not to make the same trip with Delta Airlines for another wedding in July. "It wasn't just because of the cancellation." Alicia Johnson also flew in April shortly after the federal government lifted its mask mandate for people on airlines. She continued to wear her face mask because of family members with autoimmune disorders. During the flight, she felt like the Delta airline crew was celebrating the end of the masking requirement. Taylor said, "People still want people to wear face masks. You go to any airport and they have the overhead announcements, you should be wearing a mask. And you look around and about half the people are wearing masks." Alicia Johnson is not alone in having a disappointing travel experience. J.D. Power reported that customer satisfaction with air travel in March of 2022 had decreased from the same time a year earlier. Michael Taylor attributes that change to the increase in the number of passengers. He said, "It's a great flight when you're on a 737 and there are only 10 people on it. When there are 220 people on it, that's a different experience." Alicia Johnson also saw the cost of her round-trip ticket to Minneapolis from $297 in May rise to $578 in July. According to the airline's reporting corporation, the average U.S. round-trip ticket price in April was $585, which was the highest in 7 years. Matthew Howe of Morning Consult said, I think with tickets being as high as they are, with inflationary pressure hitting people's budgets, people are really expecting airlines to perform and deliver the services that they have promised. Waring, an executive sales coordinator with the healthcare IT company, was able to depart Newark, New Jersey on a United Airlines flight at 8:30 a.m. local time on 21st of May, 13 hours after she was supposed to leave. And the flight was for Los Angeles, California, rather than San Diego, California. Her luggage had also didn't make it on the flight. That meant she not only had to drive 2 hours to San Diego, but also had to visit a Target to buy clothes. And when she finally got her bag, the handle was broken. She kept the receipts from her purchases and hopes the airline will reimburse her. Waring, a 47-year-old who lives in Bud Lake, New Jersey, said fortunately they were still able to prepare for the conference, which went well. She is still planning on flying with United Airlines in August to Florida for a family vacation. Waring said, "The bad experience is definitely not going to keep me from booking a flight." Waring said that the bad experience is definitely not going to keep me from booking a flight, adding, "I'm just going to make sure to have a good size carry on that some essentials in there."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble hadith and tradition regarding the term jama'at. Jama'at, the congregation. You know, there's a lot of terms, Islamic terms that we use, you know, all of us use, but which a lot of us aren't really aware of the true meaning of. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of these terms have been interpreted by the Prophet himself, and also by his successors, the holy imams, alayhi wasalam. So, the Prophet was asked, who are the congregation of your community? Ma jama'atu ummatik. The Prophet replied, those who are with the truth, even if they are but 10 people. So if there's a group of people who are with the truth and who are under the banner of truth and have come together under the banner of truth, even if they're a small group of people, this can be considered a jama'at. In a similar tradition, which is also very general in terms of its benefit, Imam Ali alayhi salam was asked to explain the terms sunnat, innovation, bid'at, congregation, jama'at, and division or furqa. So Imam Ali alayhi salam said the following, by Allah, the sunnat is the tradition of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Innovation is anything that deviates from it. So this hadith is interesting. It explains each subsequent term by means of the previous one. Sunnat is the tradition of the Prophet. And bid'at or innovation is anything that deviates from the sunnat. The congregation is the gathering of people who are with the truth, even if they are few in number. And division, conversely, is the dissension of people who are with falsehood, even if they be many in number. So this is probably allusion to the fact that if people come together under the banner of falsehood, in fact, they are divided. They're not really together and congregated. They don't really have a true unity. And this is kind of something that's kind of alluded to in some of the verses of the Holy Quran. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty describes the hearts of the disbelievers as being separate, disunited, kulubuhum shatta, right? So even if they're many in number, but they don't have faith, right? They're under the banner of falsehood, they will be disunited. But if there's a group of believers who have come together, and are under the banner of truth, we can consider them as a jama'at and as having unity and being one. And they will be, as the Quran says, able to overcome these people who may be many, but who are disunited and who are under the banner of falsehood. Right, so this is the interpretation of these four terms. Sunnat, the practice of the Prophet. Bid'at, the swerving away from this practice. Jama'at, the gathering of people who are with the truth, and firqat, or disunity, the gathering of together of people under the banner of falsehood. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the meaning of the term jama'at in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo